Hello again, and welcome back to the Vox Pop, WAMC's live daily afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Alan Chartok. When you're facing legal problems, it's important to know exactly what's going on. That's why you would hire a lawyer, or at least consult one. Legalese is practically a different language, and beyond that, many people don't know where to turn when they find themselves in the midst of legal trouble. We have some of the region's top legal minds in the studio with us today. Frank Lang is the president of Lang Law Firm and has an extensive litigation background. He's a member of the American Bar Association, practices elder law, including estate planning, Medicaid planning, guardianship, and planning for people with disabilities. Colin Donnarumma Esquire is president of the Capital Region chapter of the New York Civil Liberties Union. He practices law in Albany, is a PhD candidate in philosophy at the University of Albany. He is also a magna cum laude graduate of Albany Law School, served on the New York Civil Liberties Union's State Board of Directors from 2007 to 2013. So do you have a question about a legal matter or civil liberties or violations? Call us 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Colin, I'm going to start with you. What's up civil liberties-wise?
Good afternoon, Alan. Thank you for having us on. It's been a banner year for the New York Civil Liberties Union. This past year, there were a number of important legislative and legal victories. Three of the top ones I'd just like to highlight for the viewers are the NYCLU was integral in the case of U.S. versus Windsor, which was the case that went to the U.S. Supreme Court that overturned DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act, which prevented federal same-sex marriage benefits from going to legally validly married same-sex individuals. So New York, 4 years ago, passed same-sex marriage. Couples were able to get married. However, they were still actively being denied federal benefits. So the NYCLU partnered with Edith Windsor, a plaintiff, and the court wove its way all the way to the Supreme Court, and we had an important victory.
Who argued the case for you?
It was argued by a team of attorneys involving the ACLU, the NYCLU, and it was a group effort that turned out very well. Two other things I just want to touch on briefly. We'd also had extensive litigation in the U.S. District Court in the Southern District involving the stop and frisk policy, in which the NYPD was actively stopping overwhelmingly young men of color, frisking them, patting them down, asking them what they're doing when they're simply out walking to work, walking to school, and the NYCLU brought suit. We were able to win a victory in the district court, in the Southern District, which declared that to be an unconstitutional violation of the Fourth Amendment search and seizure. It looked like, under Mayor Bloomberg, that was going to be appealed and have to work its way through an elongated litigation process, but luckily with the election of Bill de Blasio, that suit has since been settled, and it looks like there's going to be serious changes involving search and seizure. The last thing I'd just like to point out, too, is that very recently, within the last month, there was a ruling on the right to protest and core First Amendment rights. When I was a young law student in 2004, I went down to New York City for the Republican National Convention, where I served as a legal observer for the protests that were occurring during the RNC. And at that time, hundreds of protesters were arrested. They were essentially just being rounded up, surrounded by orange netting and taking away for days at a time.
Yeah,
a clear violation of the right to assembly, right to protest, right to free speech, and in what's a testament to both how long circuitous litigation can be, just this past month we received a favorable ruling in a U.S. court in the Southern District saying that the NYPD had violated the protesters' rights to free speech and awarding more than $18 million in damages to individuals who had been wrongly arrested.
1-800-348-2551. And Frank Lang, what do you have to add to this?
Well, I am occasionally consulted by NYCLU on some litigation, but I'm also a general practice attorney in the Capital District area.
So people should have no problems with calling you up about virtually any legal problem. If you don't know what the answer is, you'll tell them.
I don't know.
Yeah. It's great to have you guys here. You know, we have Medical Monday every Monday, and maybe this is Lawyer Wednesday. Let's go to Kathleen in the Berkshires. 1-800-348-2551. Kathleen?
Hi. Yes, I was wondering whether you would know, regarding the Affordable Care Act, if a person is eligible for subsidized insurance, health insurance, if and especially if it should accumulate some large medical bills, that when you die, that the, at least the Commonwealth of Massachusetts can ask for repayment once your estate is filed?
Well, I'm not sure with the ACA how that works, and I don't practice in Massachusetts. I do know that, generally speaking, if you receive any kind of government benefits during your lifetime, that government agency has a right of state recovery to recover against your estate. And one of the ways that we try to circumvent that recovery oftentimes is to make sure that you don't have any assets in your estate at the time of your death. And that doesn't mean that we want to impoverish you. It just means we want to set up your assets so that when you die, they're either jointly owned, so they go automatically by operation of law to the person that you've designated as your joint owner, or that you've set up a trust and that the assets then go to the beneficiaries of that trust. I do know that in New York State, that right of estate recovery is specifically limited to your probate estate.
Okay, so if you didn't have anything in probate, there wouldn't be anything for them to recover.
Exactly. And so one of the things you may want to do is you may want to consult somebody who does that type of probate work in your state and talk about the various vehicles that there are to avoid having a probatable estate. And again, typically that would be titling the assets so that they automatically go to that named beneficiary, or setting up a trust, and it could be either a revocable trust or an irrevocable trust. Either one would work.
Why would you want a revocable or an irrevocable?
Well, typically in New York State, you want, if you're concerned about the cost of nursing home care,
sure,
you would set up what's typically referred to as a Medicaid trust, and that's an irrevocable trust that you are the creator of, or you and your spouse are the creator of. Somebody else has to be the trustee. And that trust typically would say that during my lifetime, the trustee is going to hold those assets for my benefit, but that I don't have any access to the principal. And then upon my death, those assets will go to whoever my named beneficiaries are. It's a way of sort of artificially impoverishing yourself for mm-hmm. Medicaid eligibility purposes.
And it's much harder to do that these days than it used to be, because now the government, wise to this, says, okay, you have to wait a certain number of years, right, before you can do that.
Right. Now there's a five-year look-back period for that type of a trust to be effective.
All right. So this
now
is... Go ahead.
Am I correct in that revocable and irrevocable trusts are taxed at a high rate upon your death?
Well, they're not going to change things as far as estate taxes go, but in terms of income taxation, if you had assets in a trust and the trust generated income, at the end of the year, you would get a 1099 now. Instead of coming directly to you, you would get that 1099 coming to your trust. Somebody would have to prepare a tax return from that trust. And to the extent that the trust had generated income, it's going to be taxed at a higher income tax rate than any of the personal rates. So there's a marginal increase in the amount of income tax you would pay, unless you decide to take all of that income. If you take the income during the tax year, and typically trusts are written so that you have the right to take that income, then the trust gets an income distribution deduction, so it essentially didn't retain any of the income. Mm-hmm. The tax on zero is zero, and you end up just reporting that income, whether it be income, dividends, or capital gains, on your tax return as though it came straight to you.
Fascinating. Okay. Hey, Kathleen.
Very good. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
Bye.
And we'll take them on any subject. It's up to you, and then we'll tell you if we don't know. So let's go to Kathleen in, we just went to Kathleen, to Patrick in Great Barrington. Okay, Patrick, you're on.
Hey, gentlemen. I have a question about civil liberties. 1967, there was a Supreme Court case, Capps versus U.S., and if I'm correct about my reading of it, the court expanded the Fourth Amendment definition of a reasonable search and seizure to include... what's the quote? Immaterial intrusion with technology. And in this case, it was a telephone tap that violated what they called this guy's reasonable expectation of privacy. So I wonder if you have any insight or expectations going forward with this surveillance activity with drones.
Well, so let's go. Okay. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Let's go to Colin Donorama. Okay. Do drones qualify as violative of the Fourth Amendment?
I think there's very serious concerns about the increased use of drones. I think it depends in part on how they're used, but I think that certainly people should be able to have reasonable expectations of privacy.
Why? And I've often wondered about this, despite the fact that you guys once gave me an award. Why should we have a reasonable expectation of privacy? What do I care if anybody is putting a drone over my house?
So a core principle in the U.S. Constitution is the idea of individual liberty and the idea that we should be free from state surveillance, state intrusion, unless there's some sort of probable cause or something that gives warrant for...
Well, isn't there always some kind of manufactured probable cause?
Well, sure, that's what people will claim at times, but I think that I'm glad the caller brought up drones. I think they do raise very serious concern moving forward, and I like the analogy of the telephone tap and the extension of core concepts of privacy and expectations to new technologies. This is part of the idea of the Constitution being a living document, and
right,
the fact
right,
that what
right.
we do is we take these ancient principles and we have to apply them to new technologies as they grow and advance, and I think drones very well could be a new field moving forward that we have to address.
Patrick, you want to add something?
Yeah, and I guess just one more quick thing on that note about the probable cause. I think in the Katz case, the guy was basically had an illegal gambling operation. He was transmitting information across state lines, so they might have brought in the Commerce Clause or whatever, and we won't get into that. But, I mean, with the war on terror, it seems to me that the probable cause is sometimes a little bit more manufactured than it might have been in the past. I mean, am I reaching at straws here or what?
I certainly share your concerns, Patrick. I think that's fair, and I think what we've seen is that as these technologies evolve and improve, oftentimes we see the government extending past where the appropriate line is, and we see this too with the NSA and looking into emails and tracking calls. And as they develop these new forms of technology, I think it's incumbent on individuals and on groups like the ACLU and the NYCLU to be vigilant in protecting reasonable expectations of privacy.
Well, so interesting.
Right, sort of helping the law catch up to the technology, as it were.
Absolutely. A lot of times there is this tug and pull where the technology will move past where the law is, and the law has to catch up. And
I'm not sure, that, by the way, that you know the Supreme Court will always agree with this distinguished panel, being a 5-4 Republican Supreme Court.
And you never know, but I can recall a few years ago in New York State when there was a search and seizure issue, and it was basically the police using technology to catch light leaking out of your house. And if they saw that there was an excessive amount of light and heat leaking out of your
marijuana.
House, you were growing marijuana. And I was actually shocked that the New York court struck that down and said that was an illegal search.
And I will say another case that came out of the Court of Appeals relatively recently, the NYCLU was involved.
I want to point out that the Court of Appeals is New York's highest court as opposed to...
This is
ahead,
true. The New York Supreme Court is actually...
The lowest, the trial court.
That's correct. But there was a case in which the state was investigating a state employee who was allegedly leaving work while he was on the clock and put a GPS tracking device on his car to follow his movements to see if he was leaving to go home, leaving to go elsewhere than where he should be, did not get a warrant, did not go through the court system, and it was declared that he did have a reasonable expectation of privacy in his vehicle and that was a violation of
was
his...
Was that a federal decision or a state decision?
That was a state decision analyzing the state constitution, but I think there's interesting parallels.
I'd just like to report to all of you out there that both the State Court of Appeals, our highest court here, and in Massachusetts, the highest court, tends to be a lot more liberal than the present U.S. Supreme Court does. So, you know.
I think that's definitely a fair point. You said earlier that it's a 5-4 Supreme Court, and that's right. There's 4 staunchly conservative justices, 4 somewhat liberal justices, and then Judge Kennedy.
Who every time you turn around is with the other guys, the Republican guys.
That's fair.
Almost every time. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back.
Support for WAMC comes from East Heaven Hot Tubs in Paradise Spa, Northampton, Massachusetts. Offering private hot tub room rentals with indoor or outdoor rooftop tubs, massage for couples and individuals, eastheaven.com for information. Smith College Museum of Art, hosting a public lecture by American architectural designer and artist Maya Lin, March 11th at 7:30 p.m., smith.edu/artmuseum for info. And Edward Jones, Kingston, New York. Risa Condi, Edward Jones Financial Advisor in Uptown Kingston, making sense of investing,
845-331-6293. 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. We are here with Frank Lang, president of the Lang Law Firm in Latham and Oneonta, and Colin Donorama, president of the Capital Region Chapter of the New York Civil Liberties Union. We're delighted to have both of them here. And your calls, 1-800-348-2551. Let's go to Kathy in, I don't know where. Kathy, you're on.
Yes, I have a question. Which is the best way to go legally? Is it a will or a trust when you're in your 70s?
Well, it depends a little bit on the size of your estate and like that old Fram oil filter company advertisement. Do you want to pay me now or do you want to pay me later? It's a little bit more expensive to get a trust, but generally speaking, the nice thing about a trust is if you play your cards right, that means you'll never go to surrogates court. You'll never have to pay any filing fees. You'll never hire an attorney. You'll never pay any executor's commissions. That trust will simply take care of itself when you die, and all your assets will end up going where you want them to go.
Can you have both, a will and a trust?
You can, and you typically do, even though when we set up a trust, we typically do something called a pour-over will, which essentially says, if there's anything that I still have in my name at the time of my death that didn't name a beneficiary and would have to go through probate, take it and dump it into my trust. And so it'll sweep it back into the trust, and the trust will end up being the document that disposes of all of your assets. But as I say, we try to never have to use that trust because if we're using it, it means we're back in surrogates court, even though it may be for a smaller amount of money, and that'll keep the fees down. So the nice thing about trusts are any trust will help you avoid probate. And then if you're concerned about Medicaid expenses, if you're concerned about the cost of going to a nursing home someday, then a Medicaid trust can help get you eligible for Medicaid more quickly and avoid having to spend down all of your assets before Medicaid would pick up the cost of your nursing home care.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you one other question, and that has to do with federal politics and state politics. Federal government, you die and, you know, you're sort of protected from taxation up to $5 million, right? But the states often have a much lower number. What do you do about that?
Well, again, that's a problem. Currently, New York State has $1 million cutoff for estate tax. So if you have less than $1 million, you're home free. But if you have more than that, then you have to look at some planning vehicles. And that's when people start using what are called credit shelter wills or credit shelter trusts. And when you have a married couple and you divide up your assets, and instead of leaving everything to your surviving spouse, if you know that your assets and her assets combined are going to be over $1 million, then you may choose to say, I'm only going to leave some of my money to my surviving spouse, and I'm going to leave the rest of it directly to my children, so that when the first spouse dies, we end up in a situation where the surviving spouse only has $1 million, everything else goes to the next generation. Mm-hmm. Then when the second spouse dies, the first million of that estate is going to go to the next generation estate tax-free. So it's basically a way of doubling the amount of money that you can pass on to the next generation without being exposed to estate tax.
Going to be a very hot topic in the coming weeks in Albany the state budget and the governor proposing to raise that limit well above $1 million.
What does the governor want to make it?
I believe he's proposing raising it to $5 million.
I hadn't heard that proposal for him, but I'm hoping that it comes true.
Well, there are many of us who may like that.
I have another question.
Sure, go ahead, Kathy.
What is this? Can you do a trust on the computer and then file it?
There are a number of services out there where you can get legal documents without retaining an attorney, you always run the risk of either not getting good advice or getting bad advice when you do that. So there are a lot of attorneys, and myself included, who will give you a free consultation to talk about estate planning issues. So the first thing you'd want to do is check and see if you've got somebody in your area who's willing to do that for you.
Yeah. Right.
I wouldn't, Kathy. That's my advice. Bye. Thank you. 1-800-348-2551. Two free phones. Let's go to Jim in Adams, Massachusetts. Okay, Jim, you're on.
Yes, hello. Good afternoon, gentlemen. Thank you for taking my call. I have a question that perhaps would have to do with statute of limitations. The situation is that there was at one time a person who was involved in banking in the area who was on the board of trustees of a library in this area. And from what I heard from his sole surviving heir, well, actually his sole surviving heir's wife was related to me, supposing this person who was involved in banking, one of his primary duties on the board of trustees at this municipal library was to oversee their portfolio endowment funds. and such. And supposedly during that course of his actions, took over ownership of a railroad stock bond trust fund or something to his own personal ownership and use. And this property has since then passed on to his sole surviving heir and to subsequently the sole surviving heir, a grandchild of this original person.
Well, gentlemen, isn't that theft?
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of things going on here. In New York State,
assuming the story is correct.
That would have to be proved through investigation.
There are two different things going on here. Potentially, there's a crime of theft, and then there's also a civil wrong of conversion. And the statute of limitations may be different for those in your state. Mm-hmm. It seems to me that the board or the entity on which he was serving would have to be the plaintiff or would have to bring those claims.
Yeah. Right. And you have any idea of the length of the statute of limitations at all?
I honestly don't, not in Massachusetts.
Okay. Mm.
It's so interesting that almost every family has a story of somebody who stole something, which, I would have my doubts about. But that's the way it goes. Okay, listen, Jim, thanks for calling. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you. Bye.
1-800-348-2551. Let's go to Bill in Troy. Okay, Bill in Troy, you're on.
Yes, hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was interested in hearing from Colin Donnarumma on this issue. In New York State, there's a public process system for censuring judges who are thought to be in violation of ethics or, in fact, in violation of the law. There's no such public system, as I understand it, for district attorneys. I've certainly heard anecdotally of district attorneys who have violated ethics, in fact, have violated the law. But the process of doing those investigations and bringing about any censure becomes secret because it goes to the Bar Association. Do you have any comments or thoughts on that?
It's an interesting question. I do know that there is a committee on professional standards that oversees complaints about district attorneys in New York. There's also an office out of the governor that helps oversee those efforts. I'm not sure about the nuances of the specific procedures that you're alluding to. Frank, I'm not sure if you have anything to add.
I honestly don't, because I'm more of a civil attorney, so I don't get involved in the criminal aspect of things that much. Other than the governor's office or the Committee on Professional Standards, I'm not sure who you would talk to.
Yeah,
could you tell me what role the governor plays in a process, if in fact there is any process that applies to DAs?
Well, to go to the big picture, the district attorney is considered to be a member of the executive branch. The executive branch is headed by the governor. So he falls under that branch of government within our system, which is why there's ultimately gubernatorial oversight.
And from the little I know, in some cases, when governors haven't been happy with certain DAs, they've appointed special prosecutors within that area. But again, I would caution everybody that almost everybody who's ever been prosecuted by a district attorney, has some unhappiness with that DA.
Very true.
Well, unhappiness is one thing, but violation of legal ethics, and in fact, violation of law is another thing.
Yep.
And again, we have a process in place for judges, and it's a public process.
Yep.
We don't seem to have that for DAs, and I think that's something that that warrants attention.
Thank you, Bill. Appreciate your call. Okay, let's go to Dan in Lenox. Okay, Dan in Lenox, you're on.
Hello, gentlemen. How are you? Thank you for taking my call. I appreciate it. I guess my question will be if should I retain an attorney or not. I've worked for a restaurant for the past 5 years. They're actually now my ex-employer. There's an OSHA standard, I guess, that after you work a six-hour period of time, they are supposed to give you a half-hour break. In the restaurant, it's a little difficult to give those breaks out. So we go without the break. It's kind of understood. But now I'm learning that not only was I going without the break, but they were actually docking me for the half hour that I wasn't receiving. Also, if I worked a 12-hour day, it would be an hour taken off. So the question is, do you think I should retain an attorney?
Well, I think you should certainly consult with one and see what your rights are. I'm not a labor lawyer, and I don't have enough familiarity with that branch of the law to talk with a lot of specificity. But certainly you ought to be able to find somebody who has that kind of experience who can tell you very quickly. And it may turn out, for instance, that with restaurants, there's some exemption that gets them out of having to comply with that OSHA regulation or even permits them. And again, I'm not saying that with any certainty. I'm just saying it's certainly worth talking to an attorney who can point you in the right direction.
But attorneys can be expensive.
They can be. And again, you want to look and see if you can find somebody who will. There are a lot of attorneys out there who will offer either a free or a deeply discounted consultation. And sometimes if you talk really quickly, you might be able to get that question in at the outset of your phone call to the lawyer's office, and they might be willing to tell you whether you've got a leg to stand on or not.
Colin?
But I will say it does raise a broader point about unequal access to legal assistance in this country, and the fact that if an individual, say, has an employment matter where they're out, say, a few hundred dollars, it might not be worth their while to spend a few thousand dollars trying to litigate it against someone who has more resources, which seems to reflect an inequity in the system. And one of the ways in which NYCLU is trying to address this is in the criminal realm. We have a major lawsuit going on right now called Hurl Herring versus New York State, challenging the adequacy of the indigent public defender system in New York State and individuals' ability to access quality legal representation at affordable rates or for free, which is a constitutional right, in the criminal realm is an ongoing problem in New York State. And there's important parallels to civil realm and employment issues like this, where people really need to be able to access legal counsel, and it shouldn't be contingent on whether or not they could pay, whether or not they can get justice in cases like
this.
Guys,
how do you find an attorney? What's the best way to do it if you don't know anybody?
Well, a good way is to call your local bar association and ask them for a referral to an attorney or a group of attorneys who are in that field. And quite frankly, the New York Civil Liberties Union gets a lot of phone calls, and they have a referral sort of process where if they think that you're in a particular niche, they can send you to somebody. So if for instance, you have disability issues, there are disability attorneys that they can send you to. So it doesn't hurt to give NYCLU a call sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Dan, thank you for your call. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Alan. Yeah. I appreciate it.
Yeah. Well, let's go to Marlene in Greenville. Marlene, you're up.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a gnawing question that I've been dying to ask someone. It's in regards to my family's very small. There's four siblings. My father survived my mom. And we're all older. We all moved on, and we all live in different places. When my father became very ill, although he had a will, my youngest brother stayed behind to take care of him, but the way he took care of him was to basically grab him by the hand, because my father had dementia and a bunch of problems due to alcoholism. My brother took him to an attorney, had a bunch of paperwork drawn up where all of a sudden my youngest brother was made power of attorney. He was executor of the estate. And my father had many assets, two houses, 401ks, union pensions. When my brother was confronted with this, he said that he was just trying to bury the stuff from Medicaid so that everything wasn't taken away. He was doing this for everybody. However, come to find out later that he was the only one that walked away with everything. My question is, and I called the lawyer. I found out who he took my father to, and my father wasn't in the right mind. Like I said, he had dementia to even be there. I don't know how they got this document signed. They did it behind closed doors. Is there any remedy? Could I have him investigated?
Well, yeah. I mean,
what does one do?
Okay. I mean, and this is a fact pattern that I confront on a pretty regular basis because I do elder law, and oftentimes there is a desire to protect the assets that the parent has, accumulated during his lifetime, excuse me, so that it doesn't all go up in smoke to pay for his long-term care. And usually what happens is whoever the sibling is who's closest to where mom or dad resides is the one who's making these arrangements, taking mom or dad to the attorney.
Correct.
But most of the time, if there's been a longstanding, you know, pattern, so if we can look at dad's prior wills and see that he intended to leave his assets equally to all of his children, and now suddenly there's a change and the change comes very close to the end, there's certainly a presumption that the sibling or the child who set all this thing, all these things up, may have been engaged in some self-dealing. And so when it comes time to, you know, whatever the triggering event is, so typically when dad passes away and now his assets are either going under a will or going through a trust, now is the time for those other beneficiaries to come forward and raise whatever objections they may have. And the surrogate's court in the county in which the decedent resided would be the appropriate forum to bring that kind of a complaint. So you can talk to an attorney about, you know, what that your particular fact pattern is, and see if that's something that they would be interested in representing you in. And if they are, then they would be bringing an action in the surrogate's court to have that trust or that will set aside so that dad's assets could then go in accordance with either a prior will or in accordance with intestate succession, which would mean typically that you would all share equally.
And how? What is the statute of limitations on these cases?
You know, I don't know what the statute is right off the top of my head. My guess is that if it's on a written contract like this, it's a 10-year statute or a 6-year statute. So typically, you know, there would be a big window of opportunity for you to bring that kind
and
of
Marlene,
case.
And Marlene, how long has it been?
It's coming up on 8 years now, mm-hmm. and the reason it's been so long is because the other three of us that were not involved in this, we don't have money to go see attorneys, and mm-hmm. when I did call the attorney that signed this trust or whatever, and I said, well, are we not going to surrogate's court? He said, well, there's no assets left, and I was shocked.
And that may be that because, again, the way the assets were titled, if your brother had gotten everything set up so that it was joint with dad or payable on death to him when dad died, then there wouldn't have been, anything that would have had to go through surrogate's court.
On the other hand,
I
have to say that there's probably, you know, less than 10% of the families, I'm making this up, in America that don't have a will story, you know, of some kind. So, Marlene, thank you for the call. Appreciate it. It's very helpful.
Thank you for your time.
Sure. You're welcome.
We're going to take a short break. We will be right back. 1-800-348-2551.
Support for WAMC comes from Berkshire Co-op Market Great Barrington. Offering organic and local groceries, working to build a healthy and sustainable community, Berkshire.coop. Proctor's presenting Dream the Impossible Dream, Man of La Mancha, on Saturday, March 8th. Proctors.org for tickets. The Beechwood Group of Wells Fargo Advisors, LLC. Serving not-for-profits and individual investors, Mary McDonald, Financial Advisor, and Joseph Steiniger, CFP, Financial Advisor, TheBeechwoodGroup.com. And the Pioneer Valley Chinese Immersion Charter School, a kindergarten through 12th grade public school, hosting an open house for middle and high school students on March 8th. PVCICS.org for info.
And we are back with attorneys Frank Lang, president of the Lang Law Firm in Latham and Oneonta, and Colin Ruma, I should say, president of the Capital Region Chapter of the New York Civil Liberties Union. We've heard from Bill, who says, this show is a great idea. How can an individual or a small group bringing suit against a large company for actions causing environmental contamination protect themselves against a SLAP, S-L-A-P, suit? In other words, a suit whose only purpose is to bankrupt the complainant. Who wants to handle that one?
Well, I'll give a shot at it. SLAP suits are a problem because, you know, you've got a big corporation who is bringing
unlimited money.
Yeah, and they're bringing a strategic lawsuit against public participation. They're bringing it with the purpose of squelching your First Amendment rights. And so you might be able to get somebody like the ACLU or the NYCLU interested in it if you can convince them that there is a public policy issue there that rises to the level of a civil rights issue. But then again, you may not. And it's a problem because these big companies, you know, Exxon has millions and millions of dollars at their disposal.
And a lot of lawyers, in-house and out-of-house.
Yeah. And so it's important that somebody in that situation, you know, really brings the issue to the public and tries to get enough people interested in the area and makes their case that this is an important thing that needs support. And then maybe they can get some contributions to help them. But it's, you know, it continues to be a problem.
Two things that I would add, sure. Justice. If the slap suit happens to be for defamation or slander in response to a lawsuit, truth is an absolute defense. It's important to keep that in mind.
Yeah, but you got to have a lawyer to help you establish the truth.
You absolutely do. And I think it's important to keep in mind that if the slap suit is frivolous, it's important that it be thrown out as quickly as possible in the judicial process so that you're not subject to protracted litigation. And there is legislation talking about frivolous suits that's pending. And I think it's important in these cases that if it's determined that the suit was filed out of animus, out of bad faith, it was frivolous, that individuals are subject to such a slap suit are able to recover their attorney's fees at the end of the process.
There isn't a day that some guy lies about something that really infuriates me or something. But, you know, it's almost impossible to think about going to lawyers because lawyers cost money, a lot of money.
It's a problem, and I'm glad Colin mentioned the defamation aspect because one thing that most people don't know is that if you are a defendant in a lawsuit that accuses you of defamation, typically your homeowner's insurance covers that.
Interesting.
So in this setting, if the big company was saying that you're defaming us by bringing this protest— you should always check with your homeowner's carrier and see if that action that makes you a defendant for defamation may be covered. And if so, then you get your insurance company to pay for
right.
it.
Right, and you just watch out how fast it takes before they drop your policy. Okay. David, are we done? Oh, did we have David? No, although I see what happened here. Okay. Let's go to David in Chatham. Okay, David, you're on.
Yeah, hi. I have a life insurance trust that I set up about 20 years ago, and the only thing in it is the life insurance policy.
Mm-hmm.
If I were to put assets into that today, would that skirt the 5-year Medicaid look-back period?
Well, if it's an irrevocable life insurance trust, then it's certainly irrevocable enough to protect you for Medicaid purposes. And the fact that you put your policy in many, many years ago means that that is beyond the 5-year look-back period. If you were to add new assets in now, you can certainly do that. But that new asset is going to have to make it through the 5 years before it's going to be protected for Medicaid purposes.
How old are you?
71.
Okay, well, you got time.
Yeah. Okay.
We hope so, David.
Now, seriously, I had a 93-year-old in my office this morning for a will signing, and she looked like she might be 73. So.
Yeah. That's great.
Great. Terrific.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, David.
Okay. Right, bye-bye.
Phones are filled up. We're in the lightning round. Go fast, folks. 1-800-348-2551. Casey, you're at bat. Did you get it? Casey, you're up.
Yes, thank you. It's come up several times now. I was hoping that your guest could speak to the ethics of tax maneuvers to hide your assets from, taxation. With the Medicaid or Medicare issues, it's come up several times that you can basically plead poverty when you really aren't poor to sort of keep your assets and not have them used for a program. Maybe I'm a goody two-shoes, but that seems to be against the spirit of the law.
Well, Casey,
so I was wondering if they could speak to that.
Well, Casey, that's a terrific question. I'm glad you raised it. Go ahead.
Sure, and I'd be happy to respond to it. And you're mixing metaphors there just a little bit because it's not necessarily a tax issue. But there's a good analogy to be made there. The GE Corporation in our neck of the woods here is a big player. They make an awful lot of money. They haven't paid income tax, corporate tax, for over 20 years. And nobody seems to be upset about that.
This is known as the lawyer, two wrongs make a right argumentation.
Exactly. Yeah. So, okay. The legal system is not a perfect system. It's set up to that there are rules to play by. And as long as you're going to play by the rules, I personally don't have a moral problem.
No, I agree with you. On the other hand, let's face it, the states put that 5-year period in there to stop people from going into poverty when they're really not poor, right?
And that's true. And again, you know, there are public policy issues here. Certainly one question that we could talk about is why we, unlike many other European countries, don't pay for people to go to nursing homes. Okay, we could have socialized medicine. We're getting it. We're getting in that direction with Obamacare. But we draw a distinction between what we consider to be medical issues and what we consider to be chronic care issues.
Okay.
If we're lucky enough, we're all going to live to be old enough to need to be in a nursing home. The question is, should we be paying for it individually or should we be paying for it as a group?
Good answer. Okay, Colin?
Yeah, just 2 points to add. One is certainly if an individual is uncomfortable accessing loopholes individually, the law just says they can do it. It doesn't say you have to. My side interest is pursuing a doctorate in philosophy, and there's this important can versus should aspect. So if you're not morally or ethically comfortable doing something, the law does not compel you to access the loopholes in this case, and you certainly can't. I think it's a broader and more interesting question than the GE example and broader corporations that skirt any tax obligations. Removing my NYCLU cap, I think I have a slight political disagreement with Frank. If a corporation is able to use billions of dollars generated in profits to get unequal access to the political process, to get loopholes written into the law that they then benefit from, I think it raises a fundamental question about our democracy, in which everyone is supposed to have an equal say, one person, one vote. And if certain moneyed interests are able to influence and access legislation to get the loopholes, I think it's problematic in the broad sense, although certainly based on the letter of the law, they're acting within it.
Well, Casey, thanks so much for that very good question. Appreciate it very much.
And just to be clear, I wasn't saying that I thought GE was doing the right thing.
Okay.
No. You were saying two wrongs don't make a right. That's what you were saying.
Yes.
You know, I think that's quite clear. Let's go to Cynthia Niskayuna. Cynthia.
Hey. I was laughing because I'm a retired GE employee, and I don't think they do the right thing either. So. I have a question that I'm not sure that you're all qualified to answer. It's about the congressional representative down in Florida who was found to be, I guess they call it sniffing cocaine or whatever it is they do with cocaine, and he resigned. I think he was a freshman congressman. And my question is, does he get any kind of benefits like a pension or health care, anything
okay,
like that?
Okay, good question. I'm only pushing around here, Cynthia, because I want to make sure we get as many people in as possible. Who goes first, Frank or Colin?
I'll go first just to say I have no idea.
And I just add that I know that he is entitled to certain pension benefits and to pay, but I do not know what factors can negate that and if criminal conviction for something like that would count. Certainly, we've seen parallel cases in New York. We've had no shortage of legislatures being indicted and convicted recently. And there have been issues with them being able to keep their pensions moving forward as New York State officials. And there have been calls for reform at the legislative level so that if you're indicted a crime, you shouldn't continue to get your pension.
And the third know-nothing answer, no. The other two guys knew what they were talking about. My answer would be, Cynthia, for whatever it's worth, that often the reason that officials quit fast is to hold on to their pensions. Because if they, in some cases, if it's after the fact, my sense of it is he gets to keep the money.
Oh, brother.
Yeah. Thanks, Cynthia. Appreciate it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Anna in Otis. Okay, Anna, how are things up there?
Good. I have a question. I was part of a failed rehoming adoption a few months ago, and I'm wondering, A, if I can take the parent to small claims court, and B, if I need a lawyer to do so.
Could you just explain it a little bit more for me, because I don't quite get it. You said you were part of a... Go ahead.
A failed...
Yeah.
So it was a failed adoption, so it was a private situation, but it was a rehoming, so it wasn't a birth parent.
Okay. Did you have a written contract with them?
No.
Okay. If you had a written contract, it would certainly make it easier. I don't know if this is the type of thing that would be within that would be required to be covered by an oral or a written contract. It's possible if you can show that you detrimentally relied on their promises. New York State isn't supposed to have detrimental reliance as a cause of action, but we oftentimes the courts twist things around and find that we actually do. So I think it's probably certainly worth talking to an attorney.
So what's going on here? I'm sorry. For the rest of us who don't understand it either, somebody was promised a child? Is that what about? Yes.
Yeah, they were promised that there was going to be an adoption.
Right.
You know, presumably.
And not only that, but we had the child for 6 weeks, and so we accrued costs. And so I have just sent the previous, you know, parent a bill for those costs only and have not received any response. And I do have certainly a long, you know, trail of emails and such.
Okay. Right. And typically, even if we don't have a written contract, if we can show that there was a meeting of the minds and that expenses were incurred, often New York State will permit you to recover those costs.
Is there such a thing as a verbal contract?
Yeah, you can have an oral contract.
Yeah.
And I would just add, in terms of small claims court, you do not there's not a requirement that you get an attorney. Often if you contact your local court of small claims court, they'll give you documents to tell you what the procedure is, and it's often relatively straightforward. So,
and how much money is in small claims, do you know?
It's up to $15,000.
Wow, it's a lot of money. And Anna, does that fit for your situation?
Yeah, it was about $3,500.
And you know, another thing you might want to do also is just contact the legal project at the Women's Bar Association, because they'll give you a free consultation.
Oh, okay, great.
Thanks, Anna.
Thank you.
All right, let's go to Jane in Rhinebeck. Jane.
Yes, this is kind of a desperate situation, so I'm hoping you can give me some guidance. I'm alone in the world and in my mid to late 70s and very low income, living in subsidized housing. But the only asset I have is a home in another state that I haven't been able to sell, and is really kind of a lodestone on me now because I can't afford the taxes anymore. I wonder, I don't qualify for any free legal aid because of that so-called asset. I don't know what I should do to kind of chart what's going to happen to me.
Well, Are you applying for any particular benefits now that you've been turned away for because you have that house?
No, I'm in subsidized housing, and I do get deep, and I've just gotten food stamps. But I can't get legal help on what I should do about the house and selling it. Will I lose any? You know, I just don't know what to do.
Yeah, I mean, generally speaking, if you're successful in selling the house and those assets come in, if they put you over whatever the arbitrary limit is for those governmental programs, you're going to temporarily lose those benefits. Although you may be able to give an assignment you may be able to essentially assign the house to that agency. So if you're, for instance, applying for Medicaid or if you're applying for SSI, you may be able to essentially say, hey, I can't sell the house. I'm willing to convey my interest in it to you as long as I don't lose out on these governmental programs. You want to check with the Department of Social Services in the county in which you live.
Berkshire.
And or if you've got a department of or an office of the aging, you can check with them.
And it might be worth reaching out to your local bar association, because my understanding is they don't have income or asset eligibility requirements in order to get a free consultation to meet and talk with you.
Yeah, I would like to, if the house could ever sell, have some money. It might get me above my poverty level income. You know, I hate to lose it. And and I have tried the Office of the Aging and Social Services, and I don't get very far.
There are some voluntary agencies in Berkshire County, I can tell you this much, who help with folks like yourself who may not be able to afford an attorney.
Right.
And I wrote a column on one such one in the Berkshire Eagle 2 weeks ago on a Saturday. You might want to take a look and see about that and see whether they could be of any help to you, Jane. Sorry, we're running out of time here. I appreciate your call very much.
Thank you.
Right. Let's go to Johanna in Albany. Johanna.
Hi. Is there somebody there who can answer questions about personal income taxes?
Well, you can try it, but we're really sort of out of time, so we won't. Questions would be out of the question, but question you might try. Go ahead.
Okay. Right now, a person who is currently married but filing separately pays, I understand, the highest income tax rate of any other person filing personal income taxes.
Okay, got to ask the question because we're out of time. Go ahead. What's the question?
The question is there any chance that that rule will be changed, or is there any talk about that being changed?
There's talk about it every year, but one of the problems with the tax code is that it's a tremendously voluminous document. It's very difficult to get any kind of consensus, particularly when we've got people talking about cockamamie things like throwing the tax code out and putting in a flat tax. So my prediction is that nothing significant is going to change in the tax code anywhere in the near future.
I tried to get information from the IRS. And I can never get through to anybody
okay.
on the telephone.
Johanna, I'm so sorry. I don't mean to be rude, but we are out of time, and I got to do the ending of the show. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Right. So I apologize to Jane and Francis and Cecil. Anybody who happens to be kept on the phone, and next time we'll have you guys back and we'll do more. So we appreciate this very much, guys, for coming today. And we're out of time. Thanks to Frank Lang and Colin Donorama for joining us today. Support for the Box Popcorn from Buttermilk Falls in Milton, taking reservation for dinners, spa days, and weekend escapes on a 75-acre Hudson Riverfront estate with lodging, a farm-to-table restaurant and spa, buttermilkfallsinn.com. Ye Olde Warwick Bookshop, Warwick, New York, a Hudson River Valley bookseller specializing in new and vintage books, plus collectibles and curiosities. Open 7 days a week, Ye Olde Warwick Bookshop.com, and the Beechwood Group of Wells Fargo Advisors, LLC, serving not-for-profits and individual investors, Mary McDonald, Financial Advisor, and Joseph Steiniger, CFP, Financial Advisor, TheBeechwoodGroup.com. Thanks again for everybody for joining us on the Vox Pop. Remember, the conversation continues online at WAMC Vox Pop on Twitter and Facebook.com/WAMC Radio. Our engineer has been Zach Malloy. Your calls were answered by Ryan Anglim. Our producer is Jessica Blaustein Marshall. I'm Alan Shartok. Stay tuned now for a news update.